This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents I Am Number 4 by Pittacus Lore, performed by Neil Kaplan. Copyright 2010 by Pittacus Lore. Production copyright 2010 by HarperCollins Publishers. The door starts shaking. It's a flimsy thing made of bamboo shoots held together with tattered lengths of twine. The shake is subtle and stops almost immediately. They lift their heads to listen, a 14-year-old boy and a 50-year-old man who everyone thinks is his father, but who was born near a different jungle on a different planet, hundreds of light years away. They are lying shirtless on opposite sides of the hut, a mosquito net over each cot. They hear a distant crash, like the sound of an animal breaking the branch of a tree, but in this case, it sounds like the entire tree has been broken. "What was that?" the boy asks. "Shh," the man replies. They hear the chirp of insects, nothing more. The man brings his legs over the side of the cot when the shake starts again. A longer, firmer shake, and another crash, this time closer. The man gets to his feet and walks slowly to the door. Silence. The man takes a deep breath as he inches his hand to the latch. The boy sits up. "No," the man whispers, and in that instant, the blade of a sword, long and gleaming, made of a shining white metal that is not found on Earth, comes through the door and sinks deeply into the man's chest. It protrudes 6 inches out through his back and is quickly pulled free. The man grunts. The boy gasps. The man takes a single breath and utters one word. "Run." He falls lifeless to the floor. The boy leaps from the cot, bursts through the rear wall. He doesn't bother with the door or a window. He literally runs through the wall, which breaks apart as if it's paper, though it's made of strong, hard African mahogany. He tears into the Congo night, leaps over trees, sprints at a speed somewhere around 60 miles per hour. His sight and hearing are beyond human. He dodges trees, rips through snarled vines, leaps small streams with a single step. Heavy footsteps are close behind him, getting closer every second. His pursuers also have gifts, and they have something with them, something he has only heard hints of, something he never believed he would see on Earth. The crashing nears. The boy hears a low, intense roar. He knows whatever is behind him is picking up speed. He sees a break in the jungle up ahead. When he reaches it, he sees a huge ravine, 300 feet across and 300 feet down, with a river at the bottom. The river's bank is covered with huge boulders, boulders that would break him apart if he fell on them. His only chance is to get across the ravine. He'll have a short running start and one chance to save his own life. Even for him, or for any of the others on Earth like him, it's a near impossible leap. Going back, or going down, or trying to fight them, means certain death. He has one shot. There's a deafening roar behind him. They're 20, 30 feet away. He takes 5 steps back and runs, and just before the ledge, he takes off and starts flying across the ravine. He's in the air 3 or 4 seconds. He screams, his arms outstretched in front of him, waiting for either safety or the end. He hits the ground and tumbles forward, stopping at the base of a mammoth tree. He smiles. He can't believe he made it, that he's going to survive. Not wanting them to see him, and knowing he needs to get further away from them, he stands. He'll have to keep running. He turns towards the jungle. As he does, a huge hand wraps itself around his throat. He is lifted off the ground. He struggles, kicks, tries to pull away, but knows it's futile, that it's over. He should have expected that they'd be on both sides, that once they found him, there would be no escape. The Mogadorian lifts him so that he can see the boy's chest, see the amulet that is hanging around his neck, the amulet that only he and his kind can wear. He tears it off and puts it somewhere inside the long black cloak he is wearing. And when his hand emerges, it is holding the gleaming white metal sword. The boy looks into the Mogadorian's deep, wide, emotionless black eyes, and he speaks.
The legacies live. They will find each other. And when they're ready, they're going to destroy you.
The Mogadorian laughs, a nasty, mocking laugh. It raises the sword, the only weapon in the universe that can break the charm that until today protected the boy, and still protects the others. The blade ignites in a silver flame as it points to the sky, as if it's coming alive, sensing its mission and grimacing in anticipation. And as it falls, an arc of light speeding through the blackness of the jungle, the boy still believes that some part of him will survive, and some part of him will make it home. He closes his eyes just before the sword strikes, and then it is over. Chapter 1. In the beginning, there were 9 of us. We left when we were young, almost too young to remember. Almost. I am told the ground shook, that the skies were full of light and explosions. We were in that 2-week period of the year when both moons hang on opposite sides of the horizon. It was a time of celebration, and the explosions were at first mistaken for fireworks. They were not. It was warm. A soft wind blew in from off the water. I am always told the weather. It was warm. There was a soft wind. I've never understood why that matters. What I remember most vividly is the way my grandmother looked that day. She was frantic and sad. There were tears in her eyes. My grandfather stood just over her shoulder. I remember the way his glasses gathered the light from the sky. There were hugs. There were words said by each of them. I don't remember what they were. Nothing haunts me more. It took a year to get here. I was 5 when we arrived. We were to assimilate ourselves into the culture before returning to Lorien when it could again sustain life. The 9 of us had to scatter and go our own ways. For how long, nobody knew. We still don't. None of them know where I am, and I don't know where they are, or what they look like now. That is how we protect ourselves, because of the charm that was placed upon us when we left. A charm guaranteeing that we can only be killed in the order of our numbers, so long as we stay apart. If we come together, then the charm is broken. When one of us is found and killed, a circular scar wraps around the right ankle of those still alive, and residing on our left ankle, formed when the Loric charm was first cast, is a small scar identical to the amulet each of us wears. The circular scars are another part of the charm, a warning system so that we know where we stand with each other, and so that we know when they'll be coming for us next. The first scar came when I was 9 years old. It woke me from my sleep, burning itself into my flesh. We were living in Arizona, in a small border town near Mexico. I woke screaming in the middle of the night, in agony, terrified as the scar seared itself into my flesh. It was the first sign that the Mogadorians had finally found us on Earth, and the first sign that we were in danger. Until the scar showed up, I had almost convinced myself that my memories were wrong, that what Henri told me was wrong. I wanted to be a normal kid living a normal life, but I knew then, beyond any doubt or discussion, that I wasn't. We moved to Minnesota the next day. The second scar came when I was 12. I was in school, in Colorado, participating in a spelling bee. As soon as the pain started, I knew what was happening, what had happened to number two. The pain was excruciating, but bearable this time. I would have stayed on the stage, but the heat lit my sock on fire. The teacher who was conducting the bee sprayed me with a fire extinguisher and rushed me to the hospital. The doctor in the ER found the first scar and called the police. When Henri showed, they threatened to arrest him for child abuse. But because he hadn't been anywhere near me when the second scar came, they had to let him go. We got in the car and drove away, this time to Maine. We left everything we had except for the Lorik chest that Henri brought along on every move. All 21 of them to date. The third scar appeared an hour ago. I was sitting on a pontoon boat. The boat belonged to the parents of the most popular kid at my school, and unbeknownst to them, he was having a party on it. I had never been invited to any of the parties at my school before. I had always, because I knew we might leave at any minute, kept to myself. But it had been quiet for 2 years. Henri hadn't seen anything in the news that might lead the Mogadorians to one of us, or might alert us to them. So I made a couple of friends, and one of them introduced me to the kid who was having the party. Everyone met at a dock. There were three coolers, some music, girls I had admired from afar but never spoken to, even though I had wanted to. We pulled out from the dock and went half a mile into the Gulf of Mexico. I was sitting on the edge of the pontoon with my feet in the water, talking to a cute, dark-haired, blue-eyed girl named Tara, when I felt it coming. The water around my leg started boiling, and my lower leg started glowing where the scar was embedding itself. The third of the Lorien symbols. The third warning. Tara started screaming, and people started crowding around me. I knew there was no way to explain it. And I knew we would have to leave immediately. The stakes were higher now. They had found number three, wherever he or she was, and number three was dead. So I calmed Tara down and kissed her on the cheek and told her it was nice to meet her and that I hoped she had a long, beautiful life. I dove off the side of the boat and started swimming, underwater the entire time, except for one breath about halfway there. As fast as I could until I reached the shore. I ran along the side of the highway, just inside of the tree line, moving at speeds as fast as any of the cars. When I got home, Henri was at the bank of scanners and monitors that he used to research news around the world and police activity in our area. He knew without me saying a word, though he did lift my soaking pants to see the scars. In the beginning, we were a group of nine. Three are gone, dead. There are six of us left. They are hunting us, and they won't stop until they've killed us all. I am number four. I know that I am next. Chapter 2. I stand in the middle of the drive and stare up at the house. It is light pink, almost like cake frosting. Sitting 10 feet above the ground on wooden stilts. A palm tree sways in the front. In the back of the house, a pier extends 20 yards into the Gulf of Mexico. If the house were a mile to the south, the pier would be in the Atlantic Ocean. Henri walks out of the house carrying the last of the boxes, some of which were never unpacked from our last move. He locks the door, then leaves the keys in the mail slot beside it. It is 2 o'clock in the morning. He is wearing khaki shorts and a black polo. He is very tan, with an unshaven face that seems downcast, He is also sad to be leaving. He tosses the final boxes into the back of the truck with the rest of our things.
That's it, he says.
I nod. We stand and stare up at the house and listen to the wind come through the palm fronds. I am holding a bag of celery in my hand. I'll miss this place, I say, even more than the others.
Me too.
Time for the burn?
Yes. You want to do it, or do you want me to?
I'll do it. Henri pulls out his wallet and drops it on the ground. I pull out mine and do the same. He walks to our truck and comes back with passports, birth certificates, social security cards, checkbooks, credit cards, and bank cards, and drops them on the ground. All of the documents and materials related to our identities here. All of them forged and manufactured. I grab from the truck a small gas can we keep for emergencies. I pour the gas over the small pile. My current name is Daniel Jones. My story is that I grew up in California and moved here because of my dad's job as a computer programmer. Daniel Jones is about to disappear. I light a match and drop it, and the pile ignites. Another one of my lives, gone. As we always do, Henri and I stand and watch the fire. Bye, Daniel, I think. It was nice knowing you. When the fire burns down, Henri looks over at me.
We gotta go.
I know.
These islands were never safe. They're too hard to leave quickly, too hard to escape from. It was foolish of us to come here.
I nod. He is right, and I know it. But I'm still reluctant to leave. We came here because I wanted to. And for the first time, Henri let me choose where we were going. We've been here 9 months, and it's the longest we have stayed in any one place since leaving Lorien. I'll miss the sun and the warmth. I'll miss the gecko that watched from the wall each morning as I ate breakfast. Though there are literally millions of geckos in South Florida, I swear this one follows me to school and seems to be everywhere I am. I'll miss the thunderstorms that seem to come from out of nowhere. The way everything is still and quiet in the early morning hours before the terns arrive. I'll miss the dolphins that sometimes feed when the sun sets. I'll even miss the smell of sulfur from the rotting seaweed at the base of the shore, the way that it fills the house and penetrates our dreams while we sleep.
Get rid of the celery, and I'll wait in the truck, Henri says. Then it's time.
I enter a thicket of trees off to the right of the truck. There are 3 key deer already waiting. I dump the bag of celery out at their feet and crouch down and pet each of them in turn. They allow me to, having long gotten over their skittishness. One of them raises his head and looks at me. Dark, blank eyes staring back. It almost feels as though he passes something to me. A shudder runs up my spine. He drops his head and continues eating. Good luck, little friends, I say, and walk to the truck and climb into the passenger seat. We watch the house grow smaller in the side mirrors until Henri pulls onto the main road and the house disappears. It's a Saturday. I wonder what's happening at the party without me, what they're saying about the way that I left and what they'll say on Monday when I'm not at school. I wish I could have said goodbye. I'll never see anyone I knew here ever again. I'll never speak to any of them, and they'll never know what I am or why I left. After a few months, or maybe a few weeks, none of them will probably ever think of me again. Before we get on the highway, Henri pulls over to gas up the truck. As he works the pump, I start looking through an atlas he keeps on the middle of the seat. We've had the atlas since we arrived on this planet. It has lines drawn to and from every place we've ever lived. At this point, there are lines crisscrossing all of the United States. We know we should get rid of it, but it's really the only piece of our life together that we have.
Normal people have photos and videos and journals. We have the Atlas. Picking it up and looking through it, I can see Henri has drawn a new line from Florida to Ohio. When I think of Ohio, I think of cows and corn and nice people. I know the license plate says, the heart of it all. What all is, I don't know. But I guess I'll find out. Henri gets back into the truck. He has bought a couple of sodas and a bag of chips. He pulls away and starts heading toward US 1, which will take us north. He reaches for the Atlas. Do you think there are people in Ohio? I joke. He chuckles.
Would imagine there are a few, and we might even get lucky and find cars and TV there too.
I nod. Maybe it won't be as bad as I think. What do you think of the name John Smith? I ask.
Is that what you've settled on?
I think so, I say. I've never been a John before, or a Smith.
It doesn't get any more common than that. I would say it's a pleasure to meet you, Mr. Smith.
I smile. Yeah, I think I like John Smith.
I'll create your forms when we stop.
A mile later, we are off the island and cruising across the bridge. The waters pass below us. They are calm, and the moonlight is shimmering on the small waves, creating dapples of white in the crests. On the right is the ocean. On the left is the gulf. It is, in essence, the same water, but with two different names. I have the urge to cry, but I don't. It's not that I'm necessarily sad to leave Florida, but I'm tired of running. I'm tired of dreaming up a new name every 6 months, tired of new houses, new schools. I wonder if it'll ever be possible for us to stop. Chapter 3. We pull off for food and gas and new phones. We go to a truck stop where we eat meatloaf and macaroni and cheese, which is one of the few things Henri acknowledges as being superior to anything we had on Lorien. As we eat, he creates new documents on his laptop, using our new names. He'll print them when we arrive, and as far as anyone will know, we'll be who we say we are.
You're sure about John Smith, he says.
Yeah.
You were born in Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
I laugh. How did you come up with that? He smiles and motions towards two women sitting a few booths away. Both of them are extremely hot. One of them is wearing a t-shirt that reads, "We do it better in Tuscaloosa."
And that's where we're going next,
he says. As weird as it may sound, I hope we stay in Ohio for a long time.
Really? You like the idea of Ohio?
I like the idea of making some friends, of going to the same school for more than a few months, of maybe, actually, having a life. I started to do it in Florida. It was sort of great. And for the first time since we've been on Earth, I felt almost normal. I want to find somewhere and stay somewhere. Henri looks thoughtful.
Have you looked at your scars today?
No. Why?
Because this isn't about you. This is about the survival of our race, which was almost entirely obliterated, and about keeping you alive. Every time one of us dies, every time one of you, the guard, dies, our chances diminish. You're number 4. You're next in line. You have an entire race of vicious murderers hunting you. We're leaving at the first sign of trouble, and I'm not going to debate it with you.
Henri drives the entire time. Between breaks and the creation of the new documents, it takes about 30 hours. I spend most of the time napping or playing video games. Because of my reflexes, I can master most of the games quickly. The longest it has taken me to beat any of them is about a day. I like the alien war and space games the best. I pretend I'm back on Lorien, fighting Mogadorians, cutting them down, turning them to ash. Henri thinks it's weird and tries to discourage me from doing it. He says we need to live in the real world, where war and death are a reality, not pretend. As I finish my latest game, I look up. I'm tired of sitting in the truck. The clock on the dash reads 7:58. I yawn, wipe my eyes. How much farther?
We're almost there,
Henri says. It is dark out, but there is a pale glow to the west. We pass by farms with horses and cattle, then barren fields, and beyond those, it's trees as far as the eye can see. This is exactly what Henri wanted, a quiet place to go unnoticed. Once a week, he scours the internet for 6, 7, 8 hours at a time to update a list of available homes around the country that fit his criteria. Isolated, rural, immediately available. He told me it took 4 tries, 1 call to South Dakota, 1 to New Mexico, 1 to Arkansas, until he had the rental where we're going to live now. A few minutes later, we see scattered lights that announce the town. We pass a sign that reads, Welcome to Paradise, Ohio. Population 5,243. Wow, I say. This place is even smaller than where we stayed in Montana. Henri is smiling.
Who do you think it's paradise for?
Cows, maybe? Scarecrows? We pass by an old gas station, a car wash, a cemetery. Then the houses begin. Clabbered houses spaced 30 or so feet apart. Halloween decorations hang in the windows of most of them. A sidewalk cuts through small yards leading to the front doors. A traffic circle sits in the center of town. And in the middle of it is a statue of a man on horseback holding a sword. Henri stops. We both look at it and laugh. Though we're laughing because we hope no one else with swords ever shows up here. He continues around the circle, and once we're through it, the dashboard GPS system tells us to make a turn. We begin heading west, out of town. We drive for 4 miles before turning left onto a gravel road, then pass open-cut fields that are probably full of corn in the summer. Then, through a dense forest for about a mile. And then we find it, tucked away in overgrown vegetation, a rusted silver mailbox with black lettering painted on the side of it that reads 17 Old Mill Road.
The closest house is 2 miles away,
he says, turning in. Weeds grow throughout the gravel drive, which is littered with potholes filled with tawny water. He comes to a stop and turns the truck off. Whose car is that? I ask, nodding to the black SUV Henri has just parked behind.
I'm assuming the real estate agents.
The house stands silhouetted by trees. In the dark, there is an eerie look to it, like whoever last lived in it was scared away, or was driven away, or ran away. I get out of the truck. The engine ticks, and I can feel the heat coming off of it. I grab my bag from the bed and stand there holding it.
What do you think?
Henri asks. The house is 1 story, wooden clapboard. Most of the white paint has been chipped away. One of the front windows is broken. The roof is covered with black shingles that look warped and brittle. 3 wooden stairs lead to a small porch covered with rickety chairs. The yard itself is long and shaggy. It's been a very long time since the grass was last mowed. It looks like paradise, I say. We walk up together. As we do, a well-dressed blonde woman around Henri's age comes out of the doorway. She's wearing a business suit
and is holding a clipboard and folder. A blackberry is clipped to the waist of her skirt. She smiles.
Mr. Smith?
Yes,
says Henri.
I'm Annie Hart, the agent from Paradise Realty. We spoke on the phone. I tried calling you earlier, but your phone seemed to be turned off.
Yes, of course. The battery unfortunately died on the way here.
Ah, I just hate when that happens,
she says, and walks towards us and shakes Henri's hand. She asks me my name, and I tell her, though I am tempted, as I always am, to just say, 4. As Henri signs the lease, she asks me how old I am, and tells me she has a daughter at the local high school about my age. She's very warm, friendly, and clearly loves to chat. Henri hands the lease back, and the three of us walk into the house. Inside, most of the furniture is covered with white sheets. Those that aren't covered are coated with a thick layer of dust and dead insects. The screens in the windows look brittle to the touch, and the walls are covered with cheap plywood paneling. There are two bedrooms, a modest-sized kitchen with lime green linoleum, one bathroom. The living room is large and rectangular, situated at the front of the house. There's a fireplace in the far corner. I walk through and toss my bag on the bed of the smaller room. There is a huge faded poster of a football player wearing a bright orange uniform. He's in the middle of throwing a pass, and it looks like he's about to get crushed by a massive man in a black and gold uniform. It says, Bernie Kosar, quarterback, Cleveland Browns.
Come say goodbye to Mrs. Hart,
Henri yells from the living room. Mrs. Hart is standing at the door with Henri. She tells me I should look for her daughter at school, that maybe we could be friends. I smile and say yes, that would be nice. After she leaves, we immediately start unpacking the truck. Depending on how quickly we leave a place, we either travel very lightly, meaning the clothes on our back, Henri's laptop, and the intricately carved Lorik chest that goes everywhere with us. Or we bring a few things, usually Henri's extra computers and equipment, which he uses to set up a security perimeter and search the web for news and events that might be related to us. This time, we have the chest, the two high-powered computers, 4 TV monitors, and 4 cameras. We also have some clothes, though not many of the clothes we wore in Florida are appropriate for life in Ohio. Henri carries the chest to his room, and we lug all of the equipment into the basement, where he'll set it up, so no visitors will see it. Once everything is inside, he starts placing the cameras and turning on the monitors.
We won't have the internet here until the morning, but if you want to go to school tomorrow, I can print all of your new documents for you.
If I stay, will I have to help you clean this place and finish the setup?
Yes.
Then I'll go to school, I say.
Then you better get a good night's sleep.
Chapter 4. Another new identity. Another new school. I've lost track of how many there have been over the years. 15? 20? Always a small town. A small school. Always the same routine. New students draw attention. Sometimes I question our strategy of sticking to the small towns because it's hard, almost impossible, to go unnoticed. But I know Henri's rationale. It is impossible for them to go unnoticed as well. The school is 3 miles away from our house. Henri drives me in the morning. It's smaller than most of the others I've attended and is unimpressive looking. One story. Long and low-slung. A mural of a pirate with a knife between his teeth covers the outside wall beside the front door.
So you're a pirate now, Henri says beside me.
It looks like it, I reply.
You know the drill,
he says. This ain't my first rodeo.
Don't show your intelligence. It'll make them resent you.
Wouldn't dream of it.
Don't stand out or draw too much attention.
Just a fly on the wall.
And don't hurt anybody. You're far stronger than they are.
I know.
Most importantly, always be ready. Ready to leave at a moment's notice. What's in your backpack?
5 days' worth of dried fruit and nuts, spare socks and thermal underwear, rain jacket, a handheld GPS, a knife disguised as a pen.
On you at all times.
He takes a deep breath.
And keep an eye out for signs. Your legacies are going to appear any day now. Hide them at all costs, and call me immediately.
I know, Henri.
Any day, John, he reiterates. If your fingers start to disappear, or if you start to float or shake violently, if you lose muscular control, or begin to hear voices even when nobody is talking, anything at all, you call.
I pat my bag. Got my phone right here.
I'll be waiting here after school. Good luck in there, kiddo,
he says. I smile at him. He is 50 years old, which means he was 40 when we arrived. Being his age made for a harder transition. He still speaks with a strong Lorik accent that is often mistaken for French. It was a good alibi in the beginning. So he named himself Henri, and he has stuck with it ever since, just changing his last name to match mine. Off I go to rule the school, I say.
Be good.
I walk towards the building. As is the case with most high schools, there are crowds of kids hanging around outside. They're divided into their cliques, the jocks and the cheerleaders, the band kids carrying instruments, the brains in their glasses with their textbooks and blackberries, the stoners off to one side, oblivious to everyone else. One kid, gangly with thick glasses, stands alone. He's wearing a black NASA t-shirt and jeans and can't weigh more than 100 pounds. He has a handheld telescope and is scanning the sky, which is mostly obscured by clouds. I notice a girl taking pictures, moving easily from one group to the next. She's shockingly beautiful, with straight blonde hair past her shoulders, ivory skin, high cheekbones, and soft blue eyes. Everyone seems to know her and says hello to her, and no one objects to her taking their picture. She sees me, smiles, and waves. I wonder why and turn to see if someone is behind me. There are two kids discussing math homework, but no one else. I turn back around. The girl walks towards me, smiling. I've never seen a girl so good-looking, much less spoken to one, and I've definitely never had one wave and smile as if we were friends. I'm immediately nervous and start blushing, but I'm also suspicious, as I've been trained to be. As she nears me, she lifts the camera and starts snapping pictures. I raise my hands to block my face. She lowers the camera and smiles. Don't be shy. I'm not. Just trying to protect your lens. My face might break it. She laughs. With that scowl, it might. Try smiling. I smile. Slightly. I'm so nervous I feel like I'm going to explode. I can feel my neck burning. My hands getting warm. That's not a real smile, she says teasingly. A smile involves showing your teeth? I smile broadly, and she takes pictures. I usually don't allow anyone to take my picture. If it ended up on the internet or in a newspaper, it would make finding me much easier. The two times it happened, Henri was furious, got hold of the pictures, and destroyed them. If he knew I was doing this now, I'd be in huge trouble. I can't help it, though. This girl is so pretty and so charming. As she's taking my picture, a dog comes running up to me. It's a beagle with tan floppy ears, white legs and chest, a slender black body. He's thin and dirty,
as if he's been living on his own. He rubs against my leg, whines, tries to get my attention. The girl thinks it's cute, and has me kneel down so she can take a picture of me with the dog. As soon as she starts snapping shots, he backs away. Whenever she tries again, he moves farther away. She finally gives up and shoots a few more of me. The dog sits about 30 feet away, watching us.
"Do you know that dog?" she asks.
"Never seen him before."
"He sure likes you. You're John, right?"
She holds out her hand.
"Yeah,"
I say. "How do you know?"
"I'm Sarah Hart. My mother is your real estate agent. She told me you'd probably be starting school today, and I should look out for you. You're the only new kid to show up today."
I laugh. "Yeah, I met your mom. She was nice."
"You gonna shake my hand?"
She's still holding her hand out. I smile and take it, and it is literally one of the best feelings I've ever had.
"Wow,"
she says. "What?"
"Your hand feels hot. Really hot. Like you have a fever or something."
"I don't think so." She lets go.
"Maybe you're just warm-blooded."
"Yeah, maybe." A bell rings in the distance, and Sarah tells me that it's the warning bell. We have 5 minutes to get to class. We say goodbye, and I watch her walk away. A moment later, something hits the back of my elbow. I turn, and a group of football players, all wearing Letterman jackets, sweep by me. One of them is glaring at me, and I realize that he hit me with his backpack as he walked past. I doubt it was an accident, and I start to follow them. I know I'm not going to do anything, even though I could. I just don't like bullies. As I do, the kid in the NASA shirt walks next to me.
"I know you're new, so I'll fill you in," he says.
"On what?" I ask.
"That's Mark James. He's a big deal around here. His dad is the town sheriff, and he's the star of the football team. He used to date Sarah when she was a cheerleader, but she quit cheerleading and dumped him. He hasn't gotten over it. I wouldn't get involved if I were you."
"Thanks." The kid hurries away. I make my way to the principal's office so I can register for classes and get started. I turn and look back to see if the dog is still around. He is, sitting in the same spot, watching me. The principal's name is Mr. Harris. He's fat and mostly bald, except for a few long hairs at the back and sides of his head. His belly reaches over his belt. His eyes are small and beady, set too close together. He grins at me from across the desk, and a smile seems to swallow his eyes.
"So you're a sophomore from Santa Fe?"
he asks. I nod, say yes, even though we've never been to Santa Fe, or New Mexico, for that matter. A simple lie to keep from being traced.
"That explains the tan. What brings you to Ohio?"
"My dad's job." Henri isn't my father, but I always say he is to allay suspicion. In truth, he is my keeper, or what would be better understood on Earth, as my guardian. On Lorien, there were two types of citizens, those who develop legacies or powers, which can be extremely varied, anything from invisibility to the ability to read minds, from being able to fly to using natural forces like fire, wind, or lightning. Those with the legacies are called the guard, and those without are called Seipan, or keepers. I am a member of the guard. Henri is a Seipan. Every guard is assigned a Seipan at an early age. Seipans help us understand our planet's history and develop our powers. The Seipan and the guard, one group to run the planet, the other group to defend it. Mr. Harris nods.
"And what does he do?"
"He's a writer. He wanted to live in a small, quiet town to finish what he's working on," I say, which is our standard cover story. Mr. Harris nods and squints his eyes.
You look like a strong young man. Are you planning on playing sports here?
I wish I could. I have asthma, sir, I say, my usual excuse to avoid any situation that might betray my strength and speed.
I'm sorry to hear that. We're always looking for able athletes for the football team,
he says, and casts his eyes to the shelf on the wall, on top of which a football trophy sits engraved with last year's date.
We won the Pioneer Conference,
he says, and beams with pride. He reaches over and pulls two sheets of paper from a file cabinet beside his desk and hands them to me. The first is my student schedule with a few open slots. The second is a list of the available electives. I choose classes and fill them in, then hand everything back. He gives me a sort of orientation, talking for what seems like hours, going over every page of the student manual with painstaking detail. One bell rings, then another. When he finally finishes, he asks if I have any questions. I say no.
Excellent. There is a half hour left of second period, and you've chosen astronomy with Mrs. Burton. She's a great teacher, one of our very best. She won an award from the state once, signed by the governor himself.
That's great, I say. After Mr. Harris struggles to free himself from his chair, we leave his office and walk down the hall. His shoes click upon the newly waxed floor. The air smells of fresh paint and cleaner. Lockers line the walls. Many are covered with banners supporting the football team. There can't be more than 20 classrooms in the whole building. I count them as we pass.
Here we are,
Mr. Harris says. He extends his hand. I shake it.
We're happy to have you. I like to think of us as a close-knit family. I'm glad to welcome you to it.
Thank you, I say. Mr. Harris opens the door and sticks his head in the classroom. Only then do I realize that I'm a little nervous, that a somewhat dizzy feeling is creeping in. My right leg is shaking. There are butterflies in the pit of my stomach. I don't understand why. Surely it's not the prospect of walking into my first class. I've done it far too many times to still feel the effect of nerves. I take a deep breath and try to shake them away.
Mrs. Burton, sorry to interrupt. Your new student is here.
Oh, great, send him in,
she says in a high-pitched voice of enthusiasm. Mr. Harris holds open the door, and I walk through. The classroom is perfectly square, filled with 25 people, give or take, sitting at rectangular desks about the size of kitchen tables, three students to each. All eyes are on me. I look back at them before looking at Mrs. Burton. She is somewhere around 60, wearing a pink wool sweater and red plastic glasses attached to a chain around her neck. She smiles widely, her hair graying and curly. My palms are sweaty, and my face feels flushed. I hope it isn't red. Mr. Harris closes the door.
And what is your name?
She asks. In my unsettled mood, I almost say Daniel Jones, but catch myself. I take a deep breath and say, John Smith.
Great! And where are you from?
I begin, but then catch myself again before the word fully forms. Santa Fe.
Class, let's give him a warm welcome.
Everybody claps. Mrs. Burton motions for me to sit in the open seat in the middle of the room between two other students. I am relieved she doesn't ask any more questions. She turns around to go to her desk, and I begin walking down the aisle, straight towards Mark James, who is sitting at a table with Sarah Hart. As I pass, he sticks his foot out
and trips me. I lose my balance but stay upright. Snickers filter throughout the room. Mrs. Burton whips around.
What happened?
She asks. I don't answer her, and instead glare at Mark. Every school has one. A tough guy. A bully. Whatever you want to call him. But never has one materialized this quickly. His hair is black, full of hair gel, carefully styled so it goes in all directions. He has meticulously trimmed sideburns, stubble on his face. Bushy eyebrows over a set of dark eyes. From his Letterman jacket, I see that he is a senior, and his name is written in gold cursive stitching above the year. Our eyes stay locked, and the class emits a taunting groan. I look to my seat three desks away. Then I look back at Mark. I could literally break him in half if I wanted to. I could throw him into the next county. If he tried to run away and got into a car, I could outrun his car and put it in the top of a tree. But aside from that being an extreme overreaction, Henri's words echo in my mind.
Don't stand out or draw too much attention.
I know that I should follow his advice and ignore what has just happened, as I always have in the past. That is what we're good at, blending into the environment and living within its shadows. But I feel slightly off, uneasy. And before I have a chance to think twice, the question is already asked. Did you want something? Mark looks away and glances around the rest of the room, scoots his weight up the chair, then looks back at me.
What are you talking about?
He asks. You stuck your foot out when I passed, and you bumped into me outside. I thought you might have wanted something.
What's going on?
Mrs. Burton asks behind me. I look over my shoulder at her. Nothing, I say. I turn back to Mark. Well? His hands tighten around the desk, but he remains silent. Our eyes stay locked until he sighs and looks away. That's what I thought, I say down at him, and continue walking. The other students aren't sure how to respond, and most of them are still staring when I take my seat between a red-headed girl with freckles and an overweight guy who looks at me with his mouth agape. Mrs. Burton stands at the head of the class. She seems a little flustered, but then shrugs it off and describes why there are rings around Saturn and how they're made mostly of ice particles and dust. After a while, I tune her out and look at the other students. A whole new group of people that I'll yet again try to keep at a distance. It's always a fine line, having just enough interaction with them to remain mysterious, without becoming strange and thus sticking out. I've already done a horrible job of that today. I take a deep breath and slowly exhale. I still have butterflies in my stomach. Still the nagging shake in my leg. My hands feel warmer. Mark James sits three tables in front of me. He turns once and looks at me, then whispers something into Sarah's ear. She turns around. She seems cool, but the fact that she used to date him and is sitting with him makes me wonder. She gives me a warm smile. I want to smile back, but I'm frozen. Mark again tries to whisper to her, but she shakes her head and pushes him away. My hearing is much better than human hearing if I focus it, but I'm so flustered by her smile that I don't. I wish I could have heard what was said. I open and close my hands. My palms are sweaty and beginning to burn. Another deep breath. My vision is blurring. 5 minutes pass, then 10. Mrs. Burton is still talking, but I don't hear what she is saying. I squeeze my fists shut, then reopen them. When I do, my breath catches in my throat. A slight glow is coming from my right palm. I look down at it, dumbfounded, amazed. After a few seconds, the glow begins to brighten. I close my fists. My initial fear is that something else has happened to one of the others. But what could happen? We can't be killed out of order. That is the way the charm works. But does that mean that some other harm can't befall them? Has somebody's right hand been cut off? I have no way of knowing. But if something had happened, I would have felt it in the scars on my ankles. And only then does it dawn on me. My first legacy must be forming. I pull my phone out of my bag and send Henri a text that says, C-M-E-E, though I meant to type C-O-M-E. I'm too dizzy to send anything else. I close my fists and place them in my lap. They're burning and shaking. I open my hands. My left palm is bright red. My right is still glowing. I glance at the clock on the wall and see that class is almost over. If I can get out of here, I can find an empty room and call Henri and ask him what's going on. I start counting the seconds. 60, 59, 58. It feels like something is going to explode in my hands. I focus on the counting. 40, 39. They're tingling now, as though little needles are being stuck into my palms. 28, 27. I open my eyes and stare ahead, focusing on Sarah, with the hope that looking at her will distract me. 15, 14. Seeing her makes it worse. The needles feel like nails now. Nails that have been put in a furnace and heated until they're glowing. 8, 7. The bell rings, and in an instant, I'm up and out of the room, rushing past the other students. I'm feeling dizzy, unsteady on my feet. I continue down the hall and have no idea where to go. I can feel someone following me. I pull my schedule from my back pocket and check my locker number. As luck would have it, my locker is just to my right. I stop at it and lean my head against the metal door. I shake my head, realizing that in my rush to get out of the classroom, I left my bag with my phone inside of it, and then someone pushes me.
What's up, tough guy?
I stumble a few steps, look back. Mark is standing there, smiling at me.
Something wrong?
He asks. No, I reply. My head is spinning. I feel like I'm going to pass out, and my hands are on fire. Whatever is happening couldn't be happening at a worse time. He pushes me again.
Not so tough without any teachers around, are you?
I'm too unbalanced to stay standing, and I trip over my own feet and fall to the ground. Sarah steps in front of Mark. Leave him alone, she says.
This has nothing to do with you, he says.
Right. You see a new kid talking to me, and you try immediately to start a fight with him. This is just one example of why we aren't together anymore.
I start to stand up. Sarah reaches down to help me, and as soon as she touches me, the pain in my hands flares up, and it feels like lightning strikes through my head. I turn around and start rushing away, in the opposite direction from the astronomy class. I know that everyone will think I'm a coward for running, but I feel like I'm about to pass out. I'll thank Sarah and deal with Mark later. Right now, I just need to find a room with a lock on the door. I get to the end of the hall, which intersects with the school's main entrance. I think back to Mr. Harris's orientation, which included where the various rooms were located in the school. If I remember correctly, the auditorium, band rooms, and art rooms are at the end of this hall. I run towards them as fast as I can in my current state. Behind me,